I have always been sort of aware of the effects of social media on like mental health. It's something that I've been thinking about for like a good few past few years, especially when I decided I didn't want to work in marketing anymore. It kind of spawned from myself not being in a great place mentally and just being aware of how social media was feeding into that mental space. And having young nieces who are their parents are like, oh, should we let them do this? And like, they're quite young, and seeing how they interact with social media, seeing the things that they're interested in, just being able to observe what like really young developing girls are interested in, I started to think about it a lot. And so I actually deleted social media apps off my phone a couple of years ago.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the CoLab Collective Podcast. And once again, if you are new here in the CoLab Collective Podcast, we talk about relevant topics and current events on anything tech related. And I'm your producer, Aaron, and hopefully you're having a wonderful day. In today's episode, we are going to be talking about social media. More specifically, Josh is going to be chatting with Heidi, who used to work in marketing and used to be surrounded by social media on an everyday basis. We're going to be diving deep also as well into the recent Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma. I'm sure you've heard about it, seen it, tweeted about it, Instagram, etc. It is hot, it is relevant, and it is something that we're going to be discussing in today's episode. So once again, if you have any questions or would like to suggest topics for us to talk about, you can reach us at teamcolabco@gmail.com, or you can check out our website, colabcollective.ca. You can reach us there and we'd be happy to listen to your thoughts. Once again, I'm Aaron, and hopefully you enjoy today's episode.
Cool. Let's get into it. Maybe we can start with if you want to just introduce yourself, tell the audience like who you are, what you do, and then yeah, a little bit about your background and like where you at now.
Sure. Hello, world. I am Haiti. I used to work in marketing, which is why this particular episode and topic is interesting to me. Worked in digital marketing for, I don't know, over 10 years. And now I'm a learning experience designer, kind of on the other side of things, working in learning and development and sort of focusing on not marketing at
Oh,
all,
wow.
which
Okay.
is great.
Awesome.
Yeah, I've actually like been able to fully transition out of that industry. It's got a lot of transferable skills, which is great, which is I guess why it was easier for me to move over. But definitely happy that it's not my regular 9 to 5 or my driving day job.
Well, I mean, so you've done that for 10 years. That's a long time, right? Did you love it at first? How did you first get into it?
So I took a so the real backstory was that I've always wanted to be a writer, and when I was in post-secondary, I did not necessarily shoot for that career. I actually wanted to be a forensic pathologist, so I
Oh.
got my degree in criminology. I have a double major in criminology and English, just because I never wanted to
Okay.
stop writing. And at some point I was like, yeah, people self-publish, you can get a book published, it won't be that hard. But at the time there wasn't something like Amazon to easily self-publish your own books. So I took a writing it was like writing for digital at Simon Fraser University. I
Okay.
called that. It was called I don't even know if they still have it in continuing studies. It's called New Media Journalism. And it was a fancy name for writing online. That's all that it was. It like there was
Okay.
not a lot of there wasn't a lot of strategy in it necessarily. And our instructors, bless their souls, they were sort of like well known in the Vancouver local community for having publications, online publications. One of our instructors, I think he owned ran the Tai, which is a news platform. And, you know, we had video, you know, people working in film production who had been working at the CBC. We had people who were mainly in print, I should say, print and more traditional medias. And we had one very useful course on like monetization of like, it's basically freelancing. So it was one of like the first introductions to freelancing that I ever took. And that was the probably the only useful component of that entire 8-week experience. And so that particular course on freelance, or that class within that sort of boot camp, taught us a lot about LinkedIn, taught us how to network.
Oh, wow.
Like charge for our services, what online writing looks like, caliber of writing, different stuff like that. So that was a really useful tool. And then the other thing that came out of that was I was then able to write for Tourism Vancouver, which is where I got my start. And it was just like reviewing things in the city, arts and culture related. And but it was a really big platform. So that kind of kicked off a lot of my other freelancing. And I was just freelance writing, like blog writing, publication writing, really random, lots of random stuff in writing online. And then naturally had to learn about SEO to understand optimization. And then got into a full-time role where it was social media focused, because they were like, right. Oh, we Googled you and looks like you know how to do this stuff. And I was like, damn it. I just wanted to work here for the benefits. I didn't want to work like in marketing necessarily. I just wanted to keep freelance on one side and this other.
Oh, okay.
Just for the benefits. But yeah, started working in social media, that turned into ads, that turned into managing all of the digital channels that particular company had. Okay. And yeah, it was a lot of self-taught, lots of on the job, just like, hey, we have $10,000 for Google ads, go ahead and learn it. I mean, we also worked with, they're called Major Tom now, but at the time they were Success Marketing.
Success. Okay. Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so lots of early stages, we were one of the first companies that were on Hootsuite Enterprise. So worked with a lot of some of the beta versions of their reporting and things like that. So early days of some of these platforms, working early days with Later, which was then Later Graham, and now it's Later. But
Oh, so you worked with Later?
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Worked with just lots of those new platforms coming in and how to like understand them, how to get used to them, understanding what they're for. But that was, yeah, that was a while ago. And that was like lots all self-taught because there was nobody to really teach that. And we didn't learn it in that weird boot camp.
Right. So did that include like blog writing as well?
Yeah. It was everything. It was blog writing, social ads, Google ads, worked on a couple of website redesigns. Like it was really an accelerated experience in the world of digital channels, and like both learning how to execute and strategize at the same time, because I was one of maybe 2-3 people that working on it. And one of us was a creative. So she was our graphic designer /UI/UX, like responsible for all of the visual components. So it was her, and then there was another person on our team. She was more part-time, or more so like not in the office, and eventually she left the company. So it was kind of like me and the designer working together on figuring all this stuff out. Which was like intense.
Gotcha. Well, okay. So part of the reason why we're doing this episode is to comment on the recent Netflix special, The Social Dilemma. Mm-hmm. I'm ready to jump into it. I have my nice pumpkin spice latte here and ready to dive into it. Do you have anything to drink?
I have a cold glass of water.
Okay. For those who are listening, Heidi's actually based in Toronto now. She was in Vancouver. I'm curious, like, what did you think about the movie on, I guess, just the impact now of, you know, these big tech companies and like the use of social media and how such a small thing has like grown and blown up and like what's your overall take on just like the movie?
Yeah, I have always been sort of aware of the effects of social media on like mental health. It's mm-hmm. something that I've been thinking about for like a good past few years, especially when I decided I didn't want to work in marketing anymore.
Right.
It kind of spawned from myself not being in a great place mentally and just being aware of how social media was feeding into that mental space. And, you know, having young nieces are, you know, their parents are like, oh, should we let them do this? And like, you know, they're quite young. And seeing how they interact with social media, seeing the things that they're interested in, just being able to observe what like really young developing girls are interested in, I started to think about it a lot. And so I actually deleted social media apps off my phone a couple of years ago to sort of help me clear out my own mind. And I didn't delete my accounts. Come on, I'm not crazy. So I still can access them through desktop if people want to send me links or whatever that is. And I can view them that way. But I try to train myself to not use it as a form of entertainment or just not rely on it for everything. Mm-hmm. And that was really helpful. So that's kind of where when I heard about this, and as you know, like lots of people that we know, lots of people in the tech community are all talking about it. And
yeah,
all right, I'll give it a try. So I started watching it and I was like, oh yeah, this is great. This is kind of exactly what I've been feeling from the perspective of the creators. So that's
right.
A big takeaway for me was that, oh, cool. These are the people who created the monster. And now they're talking about how it is a monster and talking about like the ugly truth about it.
Do you think it's accurate or is it a bit of like a dramatization or exaggeration of what it really is? Because this is something like we all knew, especially in the tech industry, we all knew like we're being data's being collected and all that, right? But I think they framed it in a way that was like, oh wow, like this is how far it's really gone. But is it pretty accurate in your mind?
I would say yes. I would say for people who work in tech or are aware, it's not surprising at all. Like I think it's more so how we are interpreting how this will impact people who are not in tech or who are not aware or who are more passive with their social media use than working in it or having to be in a career in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because anybody who has, they'll be like, we know this already. I think it's more interesting to talk to people who are not in the industry, who are mm-hmm. losing children, who are aware of their own mental health or who have had personal experiences with social media affecting their mental health. And so I think it's accurate. It's just that most people who are not aware would think that it's super dramatic, I feel.
Yeah.
Because it's all, everything they say is what every digital marketer does at a small scale. What every growth manager might do at a smaller scale. They're talking about like the amalgamation of all these different platforms using media for purposes that we as users don't intend and that we're essentially the guinea pigs for. We A-B test for them. They A-B test for us so that we can A-B test for them. And I feel like it might sound dramatic, but maybe that's because they're trying to highlight that it is a big deal. Like there's virtually at the time that these things were being created, no cybersecurity or cyber laws around who with this information. And so it's gotten out of hand. There's no regulation. There never has been.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is the cause for now, it's gone over the deep end, and it's the cause now to pull back and talk about it, which I think is funny. It's like you didn't figure it out before. You guys are so smart at developing these platforms, but you didn't think about the ethics and security and the regulation around this.
Yeah, I feel like I think the next big thing, incorporating like designing these apps and stuff, is like ethical boundaries and standards, like mm-hmm. ethical design, mm-hmm. And the impact of like, you know, the long-term impact of like what the ramifications are.
Yeah,
because I don't think they had that in mind when they designed it. It was just more to basically get the sale, right? Like it was just a platform for advertising, right? Yeah,
I also think too, for, you know, the founders at times are not the developers. The founders are the rich kids with ideas, or the not so rich kids with ideas, but essentially the developers come in and they go, okay, this is how we can make that idea actually happen, and I'll make it happen. So they'll go in and they'll develop what they need to. I think in the beginning it was just a pure raw feeling of how far can we go, like, because they're excited about the technology, had not right. like there wasn't a ill intention. There might have been actually a very good and positive intention, but they didn't think about all of the consequences. So for the sake of technology and science, I think they were very much like, oh, this is super cool. Let's just keep going, see what we can do. They weren't thinking about, it's like when you create, it's like in the movies when there are these scientists who create like the cure for this, and they're like, oh, but in the wrong hands, you know,
right.
you're really, it's exactly that. This is the real life that, and it's kind of funny how, you know, it's gotten very, no matter how far and how forward thinking the development actually gets, there will always be a conflict with every person who interacts. That will be like, this is super cool and I want to use it, but do I want to use it? Like Nest or Alexa or Siri. It's cool.
Yeah.
But do I want to use it? Do I want my phone to listen to me all the time? Do I want my phone to pick up these things and then somehow creep me out and show me an ad about this thing that I never typed into my phone? So the technology is cool, but it's scary at the same time.
Yeah. So what do you think about that? Like surveillance and, do you think the algorithm is set right now mainly at the end of the day is just to, you know, help companies just sell their products more, right? So it's actually just streamlining a more curated way for better products to get to you or like what you're interested.
Yeah, I think that's the case. But again, there's a fine line between doing something for the user and then doing something for the user because you know it's doing something for you.
Right.
Which is essentially these algorithms do. It's like, well, yeah, sure, we're getting our user exactly what they need, but we're also profiting, we're also monetizing, we're benefiting from this. So it's not user-centric in that sense. It's ultimately, look, if it wasn't that, these tech companies wouldn't be as rich as they are. People wouldn't own, like, I don't even know how much. I think in The Social Dilemma, they did mention how much of the economy tech drives or how much of the market these larger social media platforms own.
Yeah.
And it's quite a lot. And it's like, okay, well, if it was tech for good, which we know exists as an actual, you know, organization that exists, what's the definition of good? And that's the trouble with surveillance. That's the trouble with social media and everything, is that everyone's definition of what's good and bad is subjective. There's no
definitely
standard for that. So it can only really be driven by personal use and personal regulation. Surveillance wise, you know, I personally do not like my phone listening to me because I don't know where that data is stored. I also accept that it is what it is. Like, that's the technology.
Right.
It's just going to do that. I can turn it off, but is it really turned off? I don't even know. So what's really the point?
You could wear a tinfoil hat and live in a cave.
For sure. But I also feel like I'm okay with it in some other settings. Like, what's that thing? Do you know the doorbell that you that has a surveillance camera and you, Ring. That I can get down with because it's like home security, right? And that's like an important thing to me, but I don't need it on my phone necessarily.
It doesn't follow you like wherever you go.
Exactly. Yeah. It's meant to do its thing. It's a security function for your home. My phone is not a security tool for my body that when I walk around in the world, it's going to protect me from harm because it's surveilling me. So I think that's really weird.
Okay, so at what point did you feel like, this is kind of like invading my conscience? Because obviously, you're in it for like early on and SEO was coming up. And then you're like, hey, and you're probably doing this for companies and saying, hey, this is good for business. And we're tying it into like social media, connecting the communities. So the beginning was probably all good. And, you know, at what point did you start to feel like, this is crossing some boundaries, or at least like for yourself?
Well, I was going through personal things and like feeling really depressed, feeling really anxious. But at the time, I basically had two jobs. I was working for a growth agency whose clients were coming out of the Y Combinator program. So, startups focused on growth, focused on innovation. If anybody doesn't know what the Y Combinator program is, it's got people coming out of it like Airbnb and Dropbox and things like that. So the focus, because they've come out of that program, is on growth and acceleration. And in The Social Dilemma, they talked about kind of like the forefathers of growth hacking and what growth hacking actually looks like. And I'm really not the type of person to follow trends, even though that's what you're supposed to do in marketing. So everything that I had been doing that culminated to this point of working with this company, they do great work. They were doing great work. Very smart people, but it didn't align with what I wanted to do in life. Like I felt drained and exhausted every day.
Was it the demand that they were asking from you? Like,
no, it's a typical agency. I think a typical marketing agency, typically growth agency focused on, you know, in getting results, increasing the bottom line, getting your, it's just, I was at the end of my ringer. Like that was just like the last job that told me, oh my gosh, I'm not into it. Like I'm not cut out for it anymore. In the beginning, it is exciting. It is new, but now the technology is so advanced. Like ads have come a long way in 10 years. The internet has come a long way in 10 years. Social media has, and I'm tired to keep up with it. Like I'll spend 10, 12 hours a day in my job focusing on optimizing ads, optimizing this, looking at results, where are you at on your KPIs? Doing research, who can we talk to? All of that is so exhausting for me. And I guess you could say I just stopped caring. Like if I'm trying to search for things on my own, I'm like always looking at, how do they optimize this? What is their meta description for this? And I'm right clicking on web pages that I really don't need to. I'm viewing sources and I don't have to. Social media every day for your job, that as soon as it's time to interact with my own social media and like my family and who I choose to follow, I'm sick of it. I don't want to. And so I just noticed that I was at, and this was like about 2 years ago during that job when I had two jobs. Then at the same time at working at the agency, I'm teaching the fundamentals of doing this to new marketers. And I'm like, I can't, if I'm noticing myself not wanting to be in the industry, then I can't be excited about sharing it with other students, with students or other people. So you could see I was getting frustrated and just like falling out of love with it because, it's cool, but I'm too tired to care.
Do you think it was a factor of just overworking and focusing so much in it? And because the space that you're working with like did tie into like personal interaction, like the social media aspect, or do you think it was more of a overemphasis on like the business metrics that was kind of disassociated with, you know, the personal side?
Oh, it was all of it.
Sorry, that's a loaded question.
No. Yeah. It's a loaded question with a simple answer, which is all of the above. Like I saw how much it was encroaching on my personal life because I couldn't enjoy. It's tough to do something for your job that also is present in your personal life. Like, yeah. If you're a dentist, you're not going to go home and clean teeth. But if you're working in marketing, you're going home and interacting with all of those tools. So you can never turn it off.
You feel like you're still at work.
Exactly.
Right.
Like, I'm the loser who will look at, you know, if I'm doing a personal search, I'll judge the website, I'll judge the social media from a business perspective. So I could never turn it off. And that's exhausting. So not being able to turn it off, and then I can't enjoy it when I'm on my own, means that I have no outlet, that I have to like go and live in the trees and digitally detox, like those, you know, like, I don't know if you've heard about these things, but there are some people who will, I think they actually are super rich people who work in tech. And there was maybe a movie about this, maybe a Black Mirror, where you'll go off the grid and go to this really bougie, like middle of the desert, sustainable house, and you just don't bring your phone. Any technology, you just are, you know, one with the land or some shit like that. Oops, sorry.
Yeah.
sport.
That's all right.
but like I was getting to the point where, oh my gosh, do I need to do that weird?
Did you end up doing something like that?
No, there's no chance.
No, okay. I'm bugged, so. Have you been to Burning Man?
Nope, not
okay.
Clean. but I didn't want to go into the extremes to have to detox. I wanted to still have that mindset because I still, to some extent, even now, really like the strategy behind it. And I like the problem solving aspect of solving business problems through digital means. I just I didn't care enough about how cool it is or how interesting it is to want to solve problems that generate income.
Right.
Like I would rather consult and coach for free on marketing business strategy, because then I don't have a stake in it. And even now I'll work on marketing projects that I like, or for small businesses or entrepreneurs that I know personally that I want, because that's the impact. They just need this one thing. They need a simple website. They need to capture some, you know, allow users to interact with them. That's it. Cool. Let me help you get that set up. But I'm not interested in working for a company and like building up their bottom line based on that and running after goals that are unattainable sometimes.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about that. Like how do companies usually treat that? Because I'm sure if they're coming to you as the expert, do they just like throw, you know, crazy metrics out there, or like KPIs, like, yeah, I want to achieve X amount of dollars per month or something like that? Like,
so how
do they manage it?
That is a loaded question.
Yeah, okay.
Every business is different. Every CEO is different. And every sales or marketing director or manager is different. So whoever sets those KPIs, sets those business goals, revenue goals, are different. And so you could have a very conservative but successful in revenue business where the KPIs are manageable. They are determined based off of previous data, previous performance, and forecasted accordingly. Or you can have just like pull it out of the air. Yeah, that looks good. Yeah, let's do that as a goal. So it varies so much in terms of where those goals come from. And I think that's the difficulty, is like you as a marketer have to be flexible, and you have to change with whatever company you're with. You have to change based on the mood of whoever setting the KPIs. If you're setting the KPIs, you have to make sure that they're attainable and that they meet the business goals, the larger business goals. So your CEO is saying, hey, we want to open this many brick and mortar. Then you're like, okay, well, what revenue do we need and what goals do we need? And if it's unattainable and you tell your CEO, hey, we can't do that. Unless we get money from somewhere else, we can't do it based on the revenue that we generate or the profit that we generate.
Mm-hmm.
And if they say, oh, okay, I understand. Look, you can scale back your KPIs. But if they don't say that and they say, just make it work, then you're kind of like, okay, sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where burnout happens. And that's where overachieving.
Yeah.
For the sake of when you don't even have to. I think I've just become tired of that environment. And it is exhausting. So I definitely applaud people who have been working in it for ages, because it takes a certain mental toughness and a certain ability to put your foot down and say, like, this is not doable. And if you want this to be done, then here's what you need to get it. And it takes some time to be able to say that as a marketer, because you need experience and you need proof and you need research and you need to be able to get all that really fast to be able to say no confidently. So I do think that it's different in every business. And I don't know if it's the same for, you know, in working in as a designers, even more so now than ever, I think, are responsible, have a bigger stake than they ever have had before in pushing the bottom line, just as much as a marketer does, because there's so much that goes into user experience that affects the way that a user will complete whatever goal you want them to achieve.
Right. Yeah, I think there's more of an emphasis towards catering to the user, whereas let's say if it's more of a profit-driven business model, the needs of the user is probably at cost of just like the profit, right? So so that's interesting. Yeah, so how's your transition into, so you're doing experience design now? Like, how do you like it, shifting from marketing into design?
I love it. It's very, the funny thing is that it's very transferable, because if you think about it, learning is persuasion in a way. It's a manipulation of your own mind to absorb new things, if you can, you know what I mean? Like, whatever learning content you're interacting with, if it's not good, you won't retain it. So it's the same as whatever marketing content you come into contact with. If you don't like it, if it's not convincing, you're not going to buy it. You're not going to interact. So in that sense, a lot of the strategy components are very similar. There's an aspect of copywriting, if you think about it, because a textbook has text. Online learning experience has text. And so that's your content. That's your copywriting. If you think about it, learning experience has design elements. So it has a user experience, whether it's in person or it's online, the learner is still experiencing something. So I love it, because I can pull the business strategy out of what I used to do and have that be very sound. I can pull in the psychological elements of learning and of, you know, persuasion, almost a negotiation through text and media, that into learning experience. So that's super transferable. And then I don't have to worry about, I don't have to worry about data so much, because learning data is not as sophisticated as user data. Learning platforms are not as sophisticated at collecting data as social media platforms or the internet in general.
Right. Okay.
And I also don't have to worry about necessarily driving the bottom line, because the impact is development. The broader perspective is that if you train on, say, sales, then those people will get better and your revenue will increase, right? But I'm a lot closer to the learning component than the sales component now, which means that as long as your employees are having a great experience and you're noticing a change, I'm good.
Right. So your company is an educational platform?
Well, the company I work for is an agency that creates self-paced digital learning for corporate companies. But they were acquired by a larger company that is focused on, it's a consulting firm that's focused on things like business acumen, innovation, sales, just helping to develop businesses in these areas as a consultancy firm. So they've kind of acquired us as a way to create digital learning for those experiences, because they're mostly in-person facilitated. And now they're able
to
utilize digital learning for the same business areas.
Gotcha. Do you think that seems to be like the future now in this COVID landscape, like online learning, education, and like, if anything, do you think social media and like, all these digital tools have just like, I don't know, it's like on steroids now because everyone's at home and they're forced to be on this digital platform. What do you, are you concerned about like the state of mental health for people? Like you said, like you're always plugged in, you're at it. Are you concerned that people will just be overexposed with all this?
Yeah. I mean, especially during COVID, because there's nothing else to do. And I'm interested in the way that millennials and older interact, because these technologies emerged out of our generation, by our generation.
Right.
So I'm curious, and I think that's where the social dilemma was interesting, is because the people who developed it are millennials, and there they are sitting and telling us, you know, about what they've created. I'm very concerned for young people because there's no school, and the parents, it's a struggle to have to work from home. Then your kids over there, you have to be the babysitter at the same time. And if they're in school, you have to moderate how well they're doing virtually in school while you're working. And in the moments where it's like, well, they can't go and hang out with their friends, they can't go out, they can't go to playgrounds because everything's closed, they can't go to school and socialize, what else are you supposed to do but just, like, you're going to get mad and tell them, don't be on your tablet or don't be on your phone. You know, you need a break too as a parent. And then, I'm not a parent, but I can empathize.
Yeah.
Imagine, or I've spoken to parents who express that it is that difficult. What are you going to say? No. Like, it's almost impossible to restrict because you kind of need it for the mental break. So it's a catch-22. Like, cool, I don't want to use it too much because I know this is going to kill me some way, kill my mind some way. But I need it because I have nothing else to do. And it's one way to be entertained. So that, I think, is, especially in COVID times, is harsh because you can't really run away from it.
Yeah. It's interesting because I remember even watching like Social Dilemma. I love how they portray like these certain characters. Mm. It's kind of like a narrative of like a movie. Mm-hmm. But there's that young girl and she's just trying to, you know, get validation or get the likes and follows on social media. But like, that's like Gen Z, right? Like, they grew up with all this stuff. Whereas at least for us, we knew of life like, you know, offline interaction and stuff. And then at least I built some sense of like, I don't know, self-security or self-worth, like outside of the validation of social media. But like, what are your thoughts on how, I guess like the mental health is like developed for for new generations, the younger generation? That's a loaded question as well, but
it is. But I mean, I'm concerned for the way that young people develop self-awareness and sort of self-identity. Uh-huh. Because when I was growing up, we obviously didn't have social media. So it was whatever we compared or whatever we were exposed to was TV or school. TV, movies in school. There was nothing else, really. And if you read the newspaper, then cool. Or you looked at magazines, cool. But the volume of media and different things you can look at and the depth at which you can look at it gives you so much to compare yourself to, which is what kids are doing because they don't know the world. And so if this is how they're learning the world at a very accelerated and superficial.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
You know? And so I'm like, okay, well, the girl in the social dilemma, right? She's comparing herself to other people in a sense of it's their comments. So she doesn't even look at another person to feel the way that she feels. She just reads what people say about her or read what people say passively in a comment, and that affects her mentally. So I think that there is right now, like I know that there are digital education courses for parents, that there are people who will talk about digital responsibility in school, like teachers will talk to their students about it. But I don't know. I just don't know. I haven't done my research on how those workshops or courses have been developed, what's in them, what's the content in them, and how effective they can be. Because it's not an easy thing. It's not like, oh, we're going to have a 30-minute info session on social media for kids. And it's like, no, this is tough. Like, this is very tough. Because even as parents, you're interacting with it too. So if you say no to your kid, but you do it, and even though you are taking responsibility and you know how to do, and you can tell your kid, well, I'm older and I know how to regulate, it's still a conversation you need to have. So I'm very concerned that it just gives you this catalog to show you either what you should be, what you can't be, what other people are that you're not. It's just too much. It is exactly what you said, like an overloading of information where a kid can't possibly sift through it.
Well, it's like giving a kid it's like major dopamine hits, right? So it's like giving him cocaine or whatever, you know, to that extreme. But like this is just a thing that no previous generation has dealt with. So yeah, I feel like you need some level of, like you said, self-awareness, maturity, to handle this stuff. Because if you're so young, it's really dangerous, right?
Yeah. It's like giving a kid a bag of 1,000 flavored candies.
Yeah.
And then they lay it all out. And then, okay, which flavor do I go with first? And each flavor has a description of how delicious it is and a picture and maybe a video that tells you about the flavor and what will happen when you eat it. And you have to look at 1,000 of them every day. Like, how is that not intense for me?
It's nuts.
Yeah, it's too much choice. It's too much choice and freedom and it's ease because the user experience is so flawless.
Right.
Like the act of scrolling, the fact that you can do it with your finger. Like kids, when I remember when my nieces were really young, they just, and they figure it out. They just tap everywhere on the screen and they figure it out. And they're 2-3 years old. Like, oh man, these little munchkins are smart. I know when I got a real toy in life, I would press everything. They're doing the same thing. So I would press everything and figure it out. Like kids figured out how to use toys pretty easily because they're exploring. They're very focused on just exploring. They don't think about anything else and they want to do it. So they have this very blank slate for learning. And so the fact that they can pick up a tool and use it as powerful as a smartphone or a tablet, you know, they're going to find ways to get information that you don't even know exist. So, I mean, I know there's parental regulations on certain things, but you never know. And there was, I don't know if you remember this, but there are all these videos on YouTube that posed as kids' videos, but then they had really grotesque.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Peppa Pig or something?
Yeah, something
like
that.
It was this creepy, yeah.
It was like a scary thing and it tells you, I think there was one that tells you to like
cut yourself or something, yourself.
And I know that like a bunch of schools that I know sent out, hey, you know, this is happening, watch out for your kids, monitor what they're looking at. And I'm like, who would do that? Why would you do that to kids? Like, who created this content? And two, look how easy it is. Look how easy it is to create the content and scare a bunch of kids and like put out this fear. You know, it's so easy.
It's okay. So I was at Costco yesterday and I was looking for like dish detergent to buy. And then I saw the Tide Pods. Mm-hmm. And then that reminded me like, yeah, there's like the Tide Pod challenge and like kids actually did it. And it's like, that's nuts. Yep. I think you give them something, like you challenge them enough, and they'll like just do the craziest things. Yeah. It's pretty insane.
Or they just see other people do it and want to do it because they don't understand the consequences because they're so young. They're still developing. They're still building their experience of things, of reasons why not to do something.
Right. Testing their boundaries.
Exactly. Because when you're a kid, it's like, well, why can't I do that? Kids feel like they can do anything until they can't. And so, you know, they're still exploring their own boundaries, which means that they essentially don't have any to begin with, apart from what their parents put in front of them. So they can go and find these. And I know if I was a kid, I'd be like, oh, I'm not supposed to do that. I'm going to do it. So
you would do the pod, the Tide Pod challenge?
No, I was never that dumb. I know that that's toxic. Why would I eat cleaner? So I think my parents raised me right in that sense. I'm like, don't eat cleaning agents. Eat food. Don't eat things that are not food. Like, that made sense to me.
That's just all part of like being a teenager and just doing dumb stuff, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And social media is the best place to do it.
Yeah.
Like, I can't even imagine what bullying is like.
Yeah.
Because I think like for a time it became not cool to bully in school. Like, you don't want to be known as the person who bullies another person, because I feel like the young generation now is very aware of like mental health, which is good, which is great. But I think it comes out in other ways.
Mm.
Like, it's not as, maybe the bullying is not as outward, but the like microaggressions and passive aggressiveness, I think, really still comes through. Like, nobody would consider not liking a picture a bully, but like a form of bullying. But you get enough people who don't like your picture, all of a sudden you feel little, you feel insignificant, you feel insecure, not confident. And that's the same result as if somebody like pushed you down in the playground. So I think bullying has gotten very sophisticated over the years. That sounds awful, but I think it's just much more diverse. It's a diverse industry, this bullying. And I think the type of bully has really expanded, because I think that like nerds became trendy, whatever that looked like. And now we know like you could be interested in anything and be awesome and be cool. And you could also be completely unintelligent and dumb and mean, even if you are super smart. So it's interesting, the bullying landscape. I think, because it's so easy to bully on social media. You just hide behind an alias, you get all your friends to make fake accounts, and then add this one person and send them mean things. There's no way to really stop that, and you can continue to do it until they fold, because it's no skin off your back to just sit on your computer and bully somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty intense.
Went into a dark place there.
I was just like, I actually wanted to ask, like with these platforms and this technology, like, they're specifically designed to, obviously, like, they're so sophisticated now, and they're incorporated like social, like in the movie, they've looked in like psychology and how to attract, find ways to really make us go Wow. Sorry, I have major dad brain right now. I can't even think.
No way.
They hook us in using like psychology and all that stuff. So it's very complex, but like, and they fix like the algorithms so that they almost like alter our behaviors to get the likes and get the followers and the social validation.
Yeah.
How do you think like we can kind of still maintain ourselves while not being like chained to the algorithm?
Well, I think the first step is to know that it is an algorithm and that it is what it is, just to mm-hmm. have that level of awareness. And then I think secondly, it's decide for yourself whether or not it fits for you. Like if you're fine being in the machine and going through the algorithm and just letting it do its thing, then that's fine. At least you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you're not, then put in ways to limit yourself. Like they mentioned towards the end of the documentary the ways that those developers are limiting social media in their own lives.
Right.
And we can do the same things. So I think it all comes down to a personal choice. They'll do what they need to do ethically, the businesses.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to look out for ourselves, we shouldn't wait for them.
Mm-hmm.
We should figure out, you know, whatever we want, use a VPN, use a private, use a private search engine or something, whatever that may be. Turn off mm-hmm. your cookies, turn off your data, whatever. Even if it means you don't interact with certain platforms, you're doing something for yourself, but mm-hmm. it is a personal choice. I think that is the only way to really mm-hmm. combat this. It's how you educate yourself, your family, your friends on what's going on, and then two, how you choose to interact with it. Because to a certain extent, whatever, I'm fine with it. I get it. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. I get to enjoy the technology if I buy in, sure, but I limit my time at least. So I'm trying not to spend X amount of time every day on social media or on the internet for that matter. And it's a habit that you need to build. Take it away.
Being disciplined that way.
Because it's totally an addiction. It is drugs. It is exactly what they said in the documentary. And it feeds the same neural and cognitive purposes as drugs would. That's highly addictive. They've put the design of addiction into the user experience. So we're screwed. They're meant to be addictive. You're meant to stay engaged. Like time of engagement is a KPI. So if you know these things, then the only way to combat it is to limit it yourself.
Yeah. Do you think there's going to be like this swing reaction of people who, I don't know, just want to like somehow connect like offline or going back to the old traditional ways of connecting or something like you said, going into the woods and just like having a party or something?
No, I do not.
Okay.
I definitely don't, because the fact of the matter is we are being forced to be apart from a lot of people who are important to us now. And social media is a gift and a curse, because you can be together while being apart on these platforms. I can imagine if it's not social media, it is still like video conferencing tools like Zoom and WhatsApp, being able to see FaceTime. Like maybe that's where the uptick will be. And if I'm talking to my friends and family, I'd maybe prefer that over just direct messaging or texting, because then I actually get to see them. Even if we're far apart. But I do not think that there will be a downturn in use, because mm-hmm. it's an addiction. So unless you're going to put the whole entire world through a rehabilitation program on social mm-hmm. media, we're not going to stop the addiction. And technology is only going to get more sophisticated and interesting. So at the same time that I think it's crazy, I'm still reading about what new technology will be like, what AI and machine learning is going to bring. But I think what might increase are regulations, ethical design, and perhaps these companies putting up some sort of like just making a team focused on ethics just for the sake of doing it. So
right.
The public will think that they're working on it, but they're not. Because people do that.
Yeah, that's a good call.
People have D&I teams or DEI teams that they don't even really use or give power to. They just have it because they don't want to be seen as a racist organization.
What does that stand for?
Diversity, equity, and inclusion. Or diversity and inclusion, or diversity, inclusion, and belonging.
That's interesting.
Yeah, hearing from some people who work in that industry, they're like, well, I can't really do much. And I'm like, so what's the point? They're like, it's just so that people don't think that this company's racist, or that they're actually trying or doing something.
And, right.
I think that'll be the case with ethics in digital design. I mean, there will be people who sincerely will do it, but for other companies, there will also be just a front.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, let's leave it at that. That's kind of like where we're at in I guess the state of just, I don't know, the development of social media and companies and ethics and all that. So do you have anything else you want to share?
No, but I will say that I also have a podcast with my
partner. Yes, plug.
And we talk about the social dilemma in our latest one. So
okay.
256-bit. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it on Spotify. Hopefully the algorithm has incorporated it. But that's
awesome. And you host it with who?
With my partner.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Fantastic. All right, guys. Check out 256-bit. For just anything, like interesting topics all around, right? Like current events and things like that. Yeah,
pretty much.
Okay,
pretty
much. All right, fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us. If you guys like this episode, give us a 5 out of 5 on Apple Podcasts, but we're on all the other major platforms. So if you liked what you heard and this kind of sparked some interest and you want to ask us some questions, just email us at teamcollabco@gmail.com. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks.